special guest to join the G7 summit on Friday.
Pope Francis, who will be spearheading discussions on artificial intelligence and AI ethics.
Plus, the IAEA says Iran is expanding its nuclear capability.
These are all essentially helping to break down Iran's breakout time and working as a sword of Damocles against the West, showing that there is an expanding atomic infrastructure that Washington or other capitals can do very little about.
And later, an update from Kyiv, a look at the complicated relationship between China and Turkey. Today is Friday, June 14th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. It's a busy day in Italy as U.S. President Joe Biden and leaders of the Group of Seven wealthy democracies are meeting. Thursday's session underscored support for Ukraine's fight against Russia's invasion and the need for a ceasefire in Gaza. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara is traveling with the president. I spoke to her about what we can expect on Friday, including news of a special guest.
They will be meeting with a very interesting guest, Pope Francis, who will be spearheading discussions on artificial intelligence and AI ethics. So this will be to expand the principles that the leaders have agreed to in their last summit in Japan called the Hiroshima Framework. And Pope Francis himself has been a key proponent of AI ethics. He has what this thing that's called the Rome Call for AI Ethics that urges government and private sector to create a future where AI is serving human genius and creativity and not their, quote, gradual replacement. As you would recall, last year, the Pope himself was a victim of AI-generated memes that showed him wearing an expensive designer jacket or riding motorcycles or DJing in a nightclub. So I think he knows a little thing or two in terms of how AI can be detrimental. And so this is something that the leaders will discuss with him, and President Biden himself will have a private audience with the Pope.
Something else on the agenda at the G7 later today is China.
So this is also another complicated issue, right? I mean, these G7 leaders, what President Biden wants them to do is come up with this united front to deal with what he says are economic security threats that China poses to the global economy, such as overcapacity or, you know, flooding the global markets with electric vehicles and other green sectors. Support for Russia's war machine. This is something President Biden himself highlighted yesterday. And Beijing's trade and investment practices in developing countries around the world. So what Biden wants is for his G7 counterparts to apply maximum pressure on these issues. However, that's unclear until we see the final leader statement later on this today. However, we have seen some signals coming out. For example, from the European Union, who on Wednesday announced higher tariffs up to 38% on Chinese EVs. This echoes the move from Washington earlier this year that basically quadrupled U.S. Tariffs on Chinese EVs. So a lot of China-focused pressure today at the G7.
And what about the situation in Israel and Gaza? Has the G7 come to any conclusion or taken any action?
So they have, before the summit, they have already put their support towards the ceasefire plans that President Biden announced that has also been supported with the UN Security Council. But there hasn't been much movement on this issue. President Biden himself acknowledged this when he was asked by a reporter whether he's confident that a ceasefire could happen anytime soon. He said no, but he remains hopeful. And he stressed Thursday night during the press conference that the ball is in Hamas court. He will keep working to get a deal, but he cannot give a timeline.
Patsy Wiedekuswara is VOA's White House Bureau Chief. She's traveling with the president at the G7 summit in Italy. She joined us from Fasano, Apulia. Also in Italy, on the sidelines of the G7 summit, Ukraine and the United States signed a 10-year security agreement that Ukrainian authorities are calling legally the strongest of all agreements signed by Kyiv with the Allies. Meanwhile, G7 members agreed to provide Ukraine with about $50 billion in financial support. That's money that comes from interest earned by frozen Russian assets. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
Thursday, on the sidelines of the G7 summit in Italy, President Volodymyr Zelensky and President Joe Biden signed a 10-year bilateral security agreement, which includes provisions on the supply of military aid to Ukraine, including air defense systems and fighter jets.
Our goal is to strengthen Ukraine's credible defense and deterrence capabilities for the long term. A lasting peace for Ukraine must be underwritten by Ukraine's own ability to defend itself now and to deter future aggression anytime in the future. The United States is going to help ensure that Ukraine can do both.
The agreement contains provisions regarding weapons supply for the Ukrainian defense, including the Patriot systems and F-16 fighter jets. There is also a provision on cooperation between the defense industry of Ukraine and the United States, steps to hold Russia accountable, including sanctions and export controls, as well as support for Ukraine's future membership in NATO.
This is an agreement on steps to guarantee sustainable peace, and therefore it benefits everyone in the world, because the Russian war against Ukraine is a real, real global threat.
The deputy head of the Office of the President of Ukraine and presidential diplomatic advisor, Ihor Zhovkva, says that the legal mechanism provided in the agreement between Ukraine and the United States differs from all previous documents signed by Ukraine with partner states. There is a bilateral security agreement with the U.S., while security cooperation agreements with all other key partners. Also, the American security agreement was the first to provide that this agreement will be registered at the UN. Zhovkva noted that this will be the first legally binding security agreement for Ukraine. Until now, all other agreements signed by Ukraine with partners were only politically binding. So the American one is legally the strongest. The agreement entered into force immediately after the signing by President Zelensky and Biden and will be valid for 10 years. It will remain in effect for at least two future U.S. presidents. Zhovkva confirmed that the agreement stipulates that it will be carried out by the U.S. administration, regardless of the name of the president. For Ukraine, this is the crucial part of the agreement, as there is a fear within the society that if Donald Trump returns to the White House, he could decide to cancel the deal, as his views towards supporting Ukraine vary from Biden's approach. This is the part that Kyiv needed the most, and many in Ukraine did not expect the agreement to turn that way. In Italy, Zelensky also signed an agreement with Japan and said that Ukraine was preparing bilateral security agreements with 10 more countries. In total, Ukraine has already signed 17 security agreements. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister of Italy, Giorgia Meloni, confirmed the achievement by the leaders of the Group of Seven of a separate political agreement on providing Ukraine with about $50 billion of financial support. The money will come from the interest earned by frozen Russian assets. Ukraine will use that money mainly for defense and rebuilding purposes, as well as to support its military-industrial complex. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
In a related story, Russian President Vladimir Putin said on Friday that Russia would end the war in Ukraine only if Kyiv agreed to drop its NATO ambitions and to hand over the entirety of four provinces illegally annexed by Moscow.
Українські війська повинні бути повністю виведені із
Kyiv swiftly rejected it as tantamount to surrender. Mykhailo Podlyak, a Ukrainian presidential aide, dismissed Putin's proposal, saying it was not a serious attempt to agree on peace and had no relevance to any negotiations.
Все, що пропонує Росія, продовжує пропонувати це, звучало з першого дня повномасштабного вторгнення, це програш України.
Poliak told Reuters that there was no possibility to find compromise between Putin's statement and Ukraine's conditions for ending the war launched by Russia. Putin's proposal comes on the eve of a conference in Switzerland, to which Russia has not been invited. Turning our attention now to Iran, the UN Nuclear Agency, or IAEA, says that Iran is expanding its nuclear capabilities in apparent retaliation for the IAEA's Board of Governors censuring Tehran last week for its lack of cooperation. The IAEA notified Western media on Thursday that its inspectors found Iran installing new cascades of advanced centrifuges for enriching uranium in atomic facilities. G7 leaders at the summit in Italy said in a draft communique on Friday that Iran must stop uranium enrichment activities that have no credible civilian justification. Benam Bentaloglu is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. My colleague Michael Lippin asked him how significant the latest nuclear steps taken by Iran really are.
While some might see Iran's installation of new centrifuges as redundant, the more centrifuges, particularly the more advanced centrifuges that Iran develops, tests, and brings online, the faster it can enrich uranium to greater rates. So these are all essentially helping to break down Iran's breakout time and working as a sort of Damocles against the West, showing that there is an expanding atomic infrastructure that Washington or other capitals can do very little about.
How different are these kinds of steps from what we've seen Iran do before?
Iran largely engages in horizontal or vertical escalation, either engages in some new qualitative activity, you know, enriching to a new level or tunneling in a new location, or quantitative, you know, amassing more centrifuges, producing more uranium that it saves in a different stockpile. So this is more of the same, but the problem is the same has already been dangerous. So it's the continuation of a very dangerous trend.
The U.S. State Department spokesman, Matthew Miller, reacted to the IAEA's findings about Iran's activities by saying that if Iran actually goes ahead with these plans, we will respond accordingly. So that sounds like a threat, but how much of a toughening of U.S. rhetoric does that represent, in your view?
I don't necessarily see it as a toughening of U.S. rhetoric, but it was welcome to see, or hear, I should say, that the U.S. spokesperson did say that there would be a response. The question is, well, what kind of response? If the response is the kind of responses that we've seen over the past 3 or 3.5 years, these are the kind of pulled punches and half measures that have actually underwritten the expansion of the nuclear program and cemented the very unhelpful image in the minds of Iranian national security decision makers that the West, and in particular Washington, is irresolute and cannot afford a crisis, and therefore the regime will continue to expand its program.
What do you think of the view that the Biden administration cannot actually afford a crisis with Iran on a nuclear issue when you have so much other chaos going on in the region, especially Iran's proxy war against Israel with the conflict in Gaza?
There's no doubt that regional matters are going to complicate the nuclear one, but the problem is this failed approach, particularly starting in April 2021, well before there was this Gaza war, led Iran to enrich uranium to 60% purity, which is a hop, skip, and a jump closer towards weapons grade, which is technically 90% purity. So unless this philosophy that is underwriting this failed policy is changed, you're going to see more of the same, and you're going to continue to see the regime take advantage of this situation. The problem is we've had a crisis on our hands for a few years. It's how we deal with it that matters.
When it comes to how the U.S. and its allies in Europe are going to deal with this, what do you think are the most likely steps? And when you talk about more of the same, are you talking about more sanctions?
It's likely going to be more sanctions, more diplomatic pressure, more economic pressure. The good news is that the Europeans have been moving much, much more strongly in this direction, not just on the Iran nuclear threat, but on the drone threat, the missile threat, and the human rights issue, hopefully on terrorism as well. But that remains to be seen. The more united and the tougher a transatlantic response, the less Tehran can play a salami tactic against either side of the Atlantic.
Well, let's talk a bit about this salami tactic. What exactly do you mean, and how will Iran respond to an increase of economic pressure from the West?
Well, oftentimes Iran will try to offset pressure from one side of the Atlantic by deepening ties with the other, or by trying to threaten the escalation or the continuation of a conflict with the other. Unfortunately, this was the case during part of the Bush administration, part of the Obama administration, and even part of the Trump administration. While it's, you know, unfortunate now that there seems to be no overriding nuclear policy, the U.S. is kind of content to let the nuclear program be adrift. You know, the pursuit is not even the fatally flawed JCPOA. Really, if there's a governing philosophy of the Biden administration towards Iran's nuclear program now, it's no crisis or no war. But the regime has been able to threaten war and expand a crisis to expand its nuclear program. So if past is precedent, you're going to see Tehran try to play both sides of the Atlantic across from each other again.
VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with Behnam Bentaleblou from the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Turkey and China are making efforts to strengthen their ties, marking a significant shift after years of tension over China's treatment of its predominantly Muslim Uyghur minority. Both see last week's visit by the Turkish foreign minister to China, which included an unprecedented visit to China's Uyghur region, as a more nuanced and pragmatic approach to the issue. Turkey, a sanctuary for Uyghur dissidents, has been a vocal supporter in the past. The two countries are now eyeing greater cooperation, particularly in developing the so-called Middle Road trade route from China to Europe that goes right through Turkey. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Uyghurs are wondering, some even bracing, for ripple effects from Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan's recent visit to China and Xinjiang, the home to many Uyghurs, including Seyit Tumtuk, head of the East Turkestan National Assembly.
Bu sözünü alarak Çin yönetimi, Hakan Fidan,
he said by using his words, the Chinese administration is trying to legitimize its own genocide by justifying its own massacre, by saying that Hakan Fidan was very, very satisfied with his visit. It's unacceptable. Fidan's visit to China focused on bilateral trade and development of new trade routes as the world economy resets to circumvent sanction-hit Russia, says Marmara University's Çağdaş Ungur.
Turkey needs to rebuild all these connections in order to remain at the center of things, or still, maintaining its bridge status between East and West. Now it has become, of course, more popular because of the Russian sanctions, and Europeans are now also interested in building these alternative channels. So I think there is a window of opportunity.
Ankara is seeking Beijing's backing for a middle corridor trade route that would link China with Europe via Central Asia and Turkey. But Beijing is critical of Ankara offering refuge to China's predominantly Uyghur minority. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan accused China of committing near genocide when he was prime minister in 2009. But Ungur says Foreign Minister Fidan used more conciliatory language on the issue during his China visit and Xing.
The Chinese were happy with it. The official Chinese media discourse basically emphasized the fact that Turkey is supporting China's one China policy. Turkey respects China's territorial integrity. And there were even remarks by Hakan Fidan's Xinjiang visit where he emphasized, for instance, Xinjiang's economic development, social harmony, respect for cultural rights, etc.
Beijing is lobbying for the adoption of legislation that has been waiting several years in the Turkish parliament to be ratified. It would allow the extradition of Uyghurs wanted by Chinese authorities. Analysts say the move would help overcome Beijing's current reluctance to collaborate with Ankara, says China specialist Ceren Ergenç.
Turkey is a wild card for China. Uyghur diaspora is very strong in Turkey in terms of voter base of the conservative parties. So that also creates a risky investment environment for China. Turkey is actually officially classified as a high-risk country for investments for the Chinese companies.
Analysts warn any move by Ankara against the Uyghurs will be risky, given the solid Turkish public support of Uyghurs. But at the same time, they say Ankara is determined to achieve its goal of becoming a hub in trade routes between China and Europe. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Russian President Vladimir Putin is set to visit North Korea. It's the latest sign of deepening ties between Moscow and Pyongyang. Analysts expect Putin and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to cement security and economic cooperation agreements during the visit, which will likely begin this weekend. For more, Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
When North Korean leader Kim Jong-un visited Russia in September, he had a clear goal: to see the country's advanced weapons. Kim got a first-hand look at Russia's modern fighter jets and nuclear-capable bombers. He visited a warship, part of Russia's Pacific Fleet. And President Vladimir Putin gave him a tour of a modern space launch facility. But no agreements were announced. With Putin now visiting Pyongyang, ties may be cemented, says analyst Alexei Muravyev.
I would expect some sort of a formal outcome, formalization of relationship in more sensitive areas such as security and defense cooperation.
Putin and Kim see the world through a similar lens, despite a complicated past. As recently as 2017, Russia supported UN sanctions on North Korea. The world has changed, though. Now, Russia depends on North Korean weapons in its war in Ukraine. Both are searching for allies as part of their bigger struggle against the West, suggesting the cooperation could last. Again, Muravyev.
Putin is thinking long term. Putin is not just doing something ad hoc. He's not an ad hoc type guy.
North Korea's satellite program is a likely area of cooperation. Recent North Korean launches have shown signs of Russian help. Putin appears to be looking for more ways to help North Korea, but much of that interaction would violate UN sanctions.
Well, that's definitely a restraint. Russia has never said that it's going to stop observing UNSC sanctions on North Korea.
But Russia-based professor Artyom Lukin says there are ways for Russia to manage such restraints.
Just look at China. we all know how China complies with UN, you know, resolutions with respect to the DPRK, so I think Russia might follow the same pattern.
For Russia and North Korea, it's part of a closer alignment, and according to Lukin, possibly a formal alliance with significant impacts for the region. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.